I'm Tammy Faraday, and you're listening to Brave Journeys, the podcast about remarkable people who've navigated life's invariable challenges with courage, authenticity, grit, and grace. In the depths of Sarah Centillis' heart was a primal longing to become a mother. This yearning was buried beneath the desires and pressures of others. Sarah's husband, Eric, believed the world was already brimming with children in need of loving homes. Everyone else, it seemed, whispered doubts into Sarah's ears. Parenthood, they said, would be the end of her cherished life. But the yearning within her refused to be silenced. It threatened to fracture her marriage, until Sarah and Eric made a monumental decision that would forever alter the course of their lives, to foster a child with the hope of adoption. False starts and dashed dreams tested their resilience, but a phone call finally arrived, carrying with it the news of a fragile three-day-old baby girl desperately needing a foster family. Sarah and Eric rushed to the hospital as a couple and returned home as parents to a beautiful stranger.
The love was immediate and deep and could not be undone. And there's no way, I don't see how anyone could parent and care for an infant and not fall madly in love. I mean, I just don't see how that's possible. And we fell madly in love. And I imagined myself as her mother at the same time that there was another mother who was her mother. And so it was from the beginning complicated and beautiful and terrible and one of the most powerful things I've ever experienced.
But the foster system, with its singular objective of reuniting children with their biological parents, served as a constant reminder of the bittersweet reality that awaited them. Shaken but undeterred by the looming heartbreak, Sarah and Eric poured love, stability, and safety into the child they ached to call their own. Sarah's extraordinary book, Stranger Care, a memoir of loving what isn't ours, will shatter your heart, challenge your moral compass, and rekindle your faith in the inherent goodness that resides within each of us, even in the face of shattered dreams. But this isn't merely a tale of fiercely loving someone else's child. When a writer lays bare their vulnerabilities and exposes their own frailties, eschewing self-serving narratives, as Sarah has done, you know you've uncovered a gem. Prepare yourself for an unforgettable episode of Brave Journeys, one that deconstructs the very essence of motherhood and explores the profound truth that every child who enters our lives is at first a stranger waiting to be discovered. This is a story of belonging and loss, as well as audacious, selfless love. This is Sarah's story. Welcome, Sarah. It is truly delightful to have you.
I'm so glad to be with you, Tam. Thank you.
I don't recall having read a book replete with so many beautifully articulate, heartfelt, unrestrained testimonials ever.
Oh.
And you richly deserved every single one. I've said this to you on the phone, and it's as true as I'm here. Stranger Care ripped me apart. Your fearless humanity is as exquisite as it gets. It's no coincidence doing a show like this that I marvel at people who find not only the fortitude to share their stories, which to me is remarkable and brave in and of itself, but to do so in the complete absence of a self-serving filter. And that's why your book is a masterpiece. And clearly I'm in good company because Cheryl Strayed said the same thing. Sarah, how did you have the courage to be so vulnerable and at times self-effacing?
Well, I think when I talk to other people about writing memoir, I try to tell them that it's never good to be the hero of your own story, that the writing should be the hero, that it should be the writing that lifts people through. And I think I also was asking myself when I wrote how to be generous on the page. I was writing about people that some of them were really troubling to me. Some of them I had really, really strong feelings about, and they weren't positive, strong feelings. And so I think it's an ethical exercise as a writer. How do you show that your perspective is limited? How do you show that there's more to the other beings that you're writing about than what you can capture on the page? And so that's always an ongoing question for me. And one of the ways I thought it was important to show that was to show my own mistakes and my own failures and the ways that I caused harm to other people in my thinking and my actions. So it felt like part of that question of generosity meant to turn a critical lens onto myself and to show people the places that I went wrong.
I'm just shaking my head because that's so not only fascinating, but there's just so much grace in that. It's beautiful. And I wouldn't suggest for one second that you had done anything wrong. You were actually just giving voice to the thoughts that everybody else has in their head. That's the truth. And that's why it was so courageous, because we all have these thoughts for various different reasons and in different life experiences, but you had the courage to commit that to writing. And I take my hat off to you. To me, that was just magnificent. Hence the reason I read the book 3 times.
I know, it means so much to me. I think it's interesting in storytelling, because it's those moments that are most scary to put on the page that are the most vulnerable that actually draw people to you. So you think it might be alienating, but those are the ones that people wrote. I have these same feelings. I do the same thing in my marriage. I felt the same way, whatever it happens to be. So that's a great way to think about life, that the moments that we can make ourselves most vulnerable are the moments that draw us closer in relationship with the people that we share this planet with.
Absolutely. You and Eric marry in 2004, and your love for one another is palpable, but your feelings about having children of your own were incongruent. What were your reservations about having a child, and what were his?
It's funny, because I think I adopted his reservations about having a child. By the time I could admit to myself that I wanted to have a baby, I realized I was married to someone who did not want to have a baby. And it's one of those marriage decisions where it's not like you can have half a baby or like live part-time in babyland and part-time not in babyland, right? It only goes one way or the other. So his reservations were twofold. One are environmental. He didn't want to bring another human into the planet. He thought that there's too many of us, which I think is a growing feeling among people that we don't need to have children anymore. And he also thought, why should we make a new baby when there's so many kids who need homes? In the United States alone, there's 500,000 children in foster care. So why make another when we have a home and we could welcome someone into it? But he also had this more tender feeling, which was this idea that he didn't trust the world with his child, and he didn't want to have his heart broken by being a father. So there was some defensiveness, some hardness around that. For me, I grew up watching a mother who wanted to be an artist and was instead raising 4 children. And so there was a tension that I grew up alongside of, that somehow being a mother and being a writer were incompatible and that it would ruin my writing. But I've actually found the opposite to be true, that it was enlivening for my creative practice. And I just read the manuscript for this beautiful book by a writer named Catherine Ricketts called The Mother Artists. And she talks about how mothers pay attention, can't stop looking at the most vulnerable, like whether that's an infant or a grown child, and that the world needs the words and the paintings and the art of people who've spent so much time tending the vulnerable, that there's something transformative about that. I think that that's true.
You recognize that you'd always wanted to be a mother. I think that's where it kind of settles. Why didn't you trust your knowing, especially when someone else wanted something different? I want to know, where does that deference to other people's needs hail from? Because it's very interesting when you say about your mother sort of giving over her life to raising the 4 kids and therefore denying, in a sense, her own creative outlet or her own professional objectives. But in terms of this deference to someone else's needs, where does that come from?
You're asking me the deepest questions, Tam. You know, this is something I'm working on still. Why have I spent so many years not trusting my knowing? And everything in the universe right now in my own life is showing me you can trust yourself. You can trust what you know to be true. You've always been able to trust what you know to be true. But I didn't. I thought for a long time that my safety depended on other people around me being happy. And so I learned to push down my desires in order to make sure that the people around me were having their needs met and that their emotional needs were met. And so I think that's something that I inherited, and it's something that I'm working really hard to free myself from. And this idea of wanting to be a mother more deeply than I wanted anything and fighting for that for a decade has shown me, like, it's time. You need to trust yourself. You need to drop this because the stakes are high and there's so much that has been lost.
You write, past experience indicates we always agree. until we don't, until I wanted a baby and he did not. And by this stage, if I'm correct, please correct me if I'm wrong, you were in your early 40s. How do you make the leap? This for me was extraordinary. So I really want some clarity around this. How did you make the leap from ambivalence to then an incontrovertible longing to Eric then deciding to have a vasectomy?
you sound like my agent who read the manuscript in an earlier stage, and she wrote, she's like, something is not right here. If you and Eric wanted to adopt a baby, why the, and she swore, did you foster? I was like, oh, I have to write about my marriage. I had written around that. But I have this weird thing where I'm ambivalent. I'm not trusting myself. And then once I trust myself, I'll go to the wall for it. And that's what takes people by surprise. Like, I'm fine until I'm not. And that's another pattern I'm trying to break, like get things a little bit further upriver before it becomes catastrophic. But it was one of those things where it was my deepest longing. And I knew, you know, the day that he got his vasectomy, we got a phone call from his sister that she was pregnant. And I went upstairs and cried. I wanted that to be me. But I still didn't trust that. I thought that I would lose everything if I made that kind of demand. So at its root, it was me not trusting what I knew to be true.
Well, you keep having baby dreams. And your gorgeous therapist, Juliana, who I wouldn't mind adopting me too, only because she reminds me of mine. She's lovely and direct and fantastic, and everyone needs a Juliana. But she urges you to come clean with Eric about your desire to have a baby even after the vasectomy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that? Yep. Sorry, I know that she wasn't did. Very open-ended, but. So was that the point where you just thought, I'm going for broke here? I've got actually nothing to lose.
Well, I said my truth. I said, I want to have a baby and I want to have a baby with you. And he was like, I had the vasectomy. I changed my body. I'm not changing my body back. So that wasn't actually the moment. That was more of me saying my desire and it being met with, well, your desire doesn't matter. It's too late in some way. And so it wasn't until I became part of this really kind of witchy magic women's group. And I had this meditative experience. It's called a healing circle. And people are all around you singing, and it's very dreamlike and healing and magical, and reminds me a lot of EMDR. I don't know if you're familiar with that kind of therapy from trauma, but I ended up in this kind of dream state giving birth 3 times. At the time, I thought it was to myself, to the child we would not have, the biological child, and then to the child we would someday adopt. Now I think those 3 babies were different, but it was then that I realized I was okay to adopt. And so this kind of other path became visible where I felt like I'd had a birth experience. So I didn't need to have a baby with my body. I just wanted to be a mother. And so that opened this time where I could say to Eric, okay, let's adopt. And I wanted to adopt a baby. He wanted an older child. And so I said, I want to adopt a baby. And that's what we're going to do, or we're not going to stay together.
Well, this leads me to something really powerful. Everything you wrote was powerful, but this was really, really poignant because I've never seen the world through these eyes. I think women, by and large, are afraid to articulate their needs and their wants and their desires. I don't know if it's for fear of being classified as needy or demanding or exacting or selfish or whatever it comes from, but it's very, very challenging for us to actually say what we want and what we need, particularly if there's a price to be paid for that. But with that context in mind, you gave me so much pause when you distilled for your audience what ultimatums actually are. I have to quote you if you don't mind. You say, an ultimatum is seen as violent, a sign of weakness, a way to force someone to do what you know they don't want to do. An ultimatum is a threat. Do what I want or I'll end our relationship. But resentment ends relationships too. And when you know what you want, but you pretend otherwise, it's a poison everyone is drinking. It took this years-long fight for a baby to teach me to say what I want, to teach me that when you don't, you aren't doing anyone any favors, you aren't being the better person, the more generous one, you're being dishonest. That is so powerful. And courageously, you choose honesty from this point. Which leads you and Eric to separate for a period of time, trying to work out how you might move forward if, in fact, you move forward together. Because the mother-shaped hole was not receding in any way for you. What happens at the end of your time apart?
That time apart was only one day or 2 days or 3 days. It was like very
smart. Really?
And we were in the same house. I was I was in our room and he was in the basement. So it was like, you know, a kind of faux separation.
Cute.
I was like journaling and doing all this meditative work. And Eric went to an RV show, I think, like, in, you know, to look at camper vans. But he came back and said, I'll trust you. And I think, you know, we had to remake our marriage in order to become parents. And I think that made us better parents. What Eric finally realized is that the biggest things we've ever done in our life, the most seemingly reckless or wild, I've taken the lead on, and they've been good. Like, I forced him to quit jobs. We've moved. I've made decisions to center my art practice. The things that we've done that have actually been the most powerful and the most feeding were my ideas that I held us through. And so he chose to trust me on this one, that it would be something amazing and powerful, even though he couldn't see it at that time.
Was the thought of fostering with the hope of adopting the concession you felt would preserve your relationship?
I think it was a concession, and it was also like an ethical decision. You know, it's funny because Eric and I are both academics and we research everything. Like, Eric makes huge spreadsheets when we're going to buy a car or when we're going to buy a toaster oven. Like, we overthink everything. We did no overthinking, no research. It was like both of us were so kind of traumatized by the path that got us to this place that we just didn't do much thinking about it. And I think if we'd done more research, both about adoption agencies and nonprofit adoption agencies specifically, and if we'd done more research about foster care and in the state where we ended up, which was Idaho, which is what's known as a reunification state, like reunification happens more than 70% of the time, then I think we would have proceeded differently. But at the time, it felt like, okay, this is a way to go. These are children that need homes. The social workers that we spoke to gave us a lot of misleading information and weren't clear about what was going on. And then when they were clear, I wasn't listening. You know, I had my heart set on that we were going to foster a baby. We were going to adopt that baby, that's what was going to happen. So when they would tell me otherwise, I just didn't properly hear them.
Well, can you tell me about the grueling process of foster parent training, as well as the screening that you and Eric underwent, which is something that we should note, that people who choose to procreate are never, ever subjected to?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, the state is trusting you with someone else's child. So the procedure to get certified should be super rigorous, but it felt like it was rigorous in the wrong ways. Like, the questions they were asking weren't the questions that would actually produce proper parenting for a child. So we went through it first in Oregon before we moved to Idaho. And then after a really grueling process, we ended that situation and started over again in Idaho. But you have to welcome social workers in your home who ask you about your family history, who ask you about your like drinking and drug habits, who ask you about your sex life, who ask you about whether you've been in therapy, who get upset about information that doesn't seem upsetting and don't get upset about information that should seem upsetting. In Idaho, you have to take a series of classes that help you learn how to be in relationship with birth families and help you parent a child who may have been traumatized in some way. So some of it's really useful and other parts of it are ridiculous and not useful at all.
Well, you were asked to be candid about the limits of what you could and couldn't handle, because children who enter the foster system have invariably seen the worst of life before they've ever been placed with a foster family, not to mention if they've been in care for a long period of time. So for people who've never experienced foster parenting, can you give me some insight into the types of neglect, trauma, and abuse that many of these children have endured, and why one of the social workers tell you that perhaps you're shopping at the wrong stall?
Yeah, I was really excited about being a foster parent. Like, I was excited about welcoming into our home a child that needed a safe place to be. And it was, for me, how I thought we were going to grow our family. And so it seemed like an act of love and welcome and this idea that family is a practice. It's not something that you are, it's something that you do. Kinship is something that we do for one another. So it felt that way to me. And that's how I talked to the social workers about it. But how they talked to me about it were about children being abused, abandoned, and neglected by their parents. We got a phone call for one child who'd been left alone for days and days at a time. And when people arrived to finally help that child, they thought the child was 1 year old, but it turns out the child was 3 years old. And it looks like no food in the refrigerator, spoiled milk, no one changing diapers. It can also look like hitting. It can look like all kinds of violence, sexual abuse, emotional abuse. They would ask us questions like, how do you love a child? How do you show affection to a child who's only known touch as harm? And then how do you show affection to a child who's only known affection as touch, whether that's appropriate or inappropriate? So we had to learn all these things, like when you would welcome a child into your home, if you were going to watch movies together, every child would have their own blanket. Like, you don't share blankets. You don't sit on their bed when you read them a bedtime story. You sit next to the bed. You learn that doing chores together or making dinner alongside each other or baking cookies together is a way to show affection. So the social workers that we worked with have seen the worst that humans do to one another. There are these very, very traumatized people who aren't allowed to be traumatized, who aren't treated as people who are witnessing trauma on a daily basis. And as a result, they've kind of shut some of that off. And I think they went into this profession because they want to help the most vulnerable children. That are foster children are arguably the most vulnerable, but there's only so much a heart can take if you want to keep on doing that kind of work. So it was a profound experience. And as hard as it is to hear about it, then you have to remember there's children that are living through that. I think one of the things we do as a society is make foster children seem like there's something wrong with them or dangerous. People would tell me all these stories. Oh, I knew someone who fostered and that kid did XYZ or ruined this or did this violent thing or stole this money. And, you know, they're the symptoms of our own violence. Like, we're responsible to them and we belong to them and they've done nothing wrong. And that was the most powerful thing I think that the foster training system told us, which was that these children are innocent. They've done no wrong. The only thing that's been done wrong is to them. They've done nothing wrong themselves. And so what does it look like to feel responsible for those kids?
That's really powerful. And that's so important that you said that. So thank you so much for saying that. And I was just going to ask you though, as a woman who's longing to become a mother, how do you reconcile the rules and regulations around creating a safe home, as you've alluded to, you know, having a separate blanket, the child never being able to go into the master bedroom, because obviously you have empathy for a child who's experienced so much trauma and pain, otherwise you wouldn't have entered this system in the first place. But when social workers, for example, put prescriptions on how you can show kindness, affection, and love to a child you long to be able to parent, does that feel challenging beyond a point that you can actually manage that? How do you assimilate that into your thinking of what parenthood might look like if you receive a child who's had so much trauma that you can't be in a bedroom with them, for example, unless the door is open, they can't shower unless they're in their bathers or swimsuits, as you would say? How does that work?
Well, I think it forced me to realize that in my imagination, what motherhood looks like is very intimate. It's filled with touch and hugs and cuddling on the couch and reading books. And it's just an intimate physical kind of activity. So it made me wonder, what other ways can we parent? What might love look like? I mean, we ended up welcoming an infant. So of course, that is very physical and intimate. And there's no way that you can't not have the infant in the primary bedroom. You can't not hold them. Like, you can't be like, well, good luck, kid, you know, sit on the couch by yourself. It was very intimate. But I think being a foster parent prepared me to be a better parent than I would have been otherwise, because what you have to center is not your need, not your fantasy about what parenting looks like. It's gonna make me cry a little bit, but what the child needs. And I think adoptive parenting and foster parenting allows you to do that in a way that I think maybe biological parenting sometimes doesn't, because we imagine biological children as somehow these copies of us, or like they're just like us, even though they're not. They're strangers just as much as a foster child or an adoptive child would be. They're all the children we welcome into our lives are strangers.
Of course.
And our job is to help them become what the person that they are meant to be or want to be or long to be. But when you become a foster parent, you have to think differently. Like, it's the child's needs that matter the most. Like, it's what the child needs. And that is often different than what you imagined your needs as a parent might be. And so I think that's a really powerful experience.
Well, it's the most selfless form of parenting. It's not about you actually at all, if you do it right.
At all.
At all.
At all. Yeah.
Sarah, what is Stranger Care?
Stranger Care is the name that Eric and I were technically called by the foster care system. So we were non-relative care providers, or stranger care, which is a real alienating term for this intimate task that you're being asked to do. But that's what we were known as. We were called stranger care. And so then I just started thinking about what a beautiful phrase that is and how the world needs more stranger care. And so I started looking at the natural world and to animals and trees and other humans that do love better than I do for examples of stranger care, of cross-species love, or how birds tend their young, or the way refugees are cared for or not. And a friend of mine read Stranger Care, and she said, you know, I love the way in the beginning of the book, you're looking to nature for examples of stranger care. And by the end of the book, nature's taking care of you. I was like, oh, I didn't realize that. But yeah, that's exactly what happened.
It's true.
So I just tried to reclaim that word as something powerful and something that all of us need.
What does it really mean when you're told, we don't find kids for homes, we find homes for kids?
I think that was what they said to us in Idaho. And they were really pushing back against the fact that I wanted to welcome a baby that I could then adopt. And so that was me having this desire, right? This desire that I'd worked really hard to be able to say and claim and bring into being. And they were basically saying to me, the system doesn't work that way. It's kid-centered. What I just said to you before about love, it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with what the child needs and wants. And they were being very clear that they were not an adoption agency. I think that's right. We don't want to be in a place where the government is taking people's babies. We lived that for a long time in the United States, whether you're talking about what happened to Native American children or still the racist system now that Black children are more likely to be in foster care and they're more likely not to be returned to their parents. I think that's the ethical way to go. But I don't think the system as it's set up is designed to center kids in the way that it should, even though the rhetoric is maybe kid-centric.
Sarah, can you tell me about the children you couldn't welcome into your home and the toll that it took on you to say no? Because your telling of this made me love you even more.
I felt a lot of shame around it. So that's beautiful to hear that. But one of the things that they have you do, and this is true if you're preparing to adopt a child too, is the foster care system recommends that you make a list of what your family's willing and able to receive. And there's like a long list. Children have all kinds of needs, physical needs, mental needs, emotional needs. They've been through all kinds of things. And so it's important to be honest about what you're capable of. You don't want to welcome a child into your home on principle because you feel too bad to say no. And then you're not the right home for that child. And then they have to leave and get rehomed. It's like a very violent thing. But we got this phone call, and I alluded to it earlier. We got this phone call for this child that had been left alone in an apartment really, really close to our house. And we'd been told that almost no children come into foster care in our town. We live in kind of a well-to-do little valley town, and they said that the children would be coming from far away. But this child was really close to us and then had massive, massive needs that we didn't feel like we were capable of caring for. And we ended up saying yes when we had half of the information, and we set up our house to receive this child and then got a lot more information, and we had to say no and put everything away. And it was devastating. I just felt like I had failed, that I wasn't who I had imagined myself to be. But the outcome of that story is that that child got placed with exactly the right person. The child was placed with their occupational therapist, a physical therapist who had all the kinds of skills that this particular child needed and who knew this child before and was better equipped. And so part of not setting limits is thinking that you're the only one that can fix everything. It's kind of the savior complex. It's a kind of narcissistic. And so there's something powerful about saying it's not me and there will be someone else who is better than I am for this particular child. But it was a very painful, shame-filled experience.
How did you come to meet the tiny baby girl that would become your foster daughter, Coco?
We got a phone call at 11 in the morning that there was a baby, a 3-day-old baby girl who weighed less than 5 pounds and who needed a home. And we got the call at 11, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we were holding her in our arms, and she was tiny and beautiful and perfect. And we fell madly in love with her from the minute we saw her.
What did you know of Coco's biological mother, Evelyn? Why was she deemed a poor prognosis?
I don't remember what we knew at the very beginning, but this particular baby was her fourth child. And we didn't know that in the beginning. But when the social worker called, I asked the questions that I usually ask, and they knew that we wanted to adopt. So I was asking, is this a baby that we might get to parent for the rest of that child's life? And she was like, for sure, basically. Like, this mother is not going to get it together. I don't think there's any way that she's going to be able to parent this baby. So from the beginning, we were told that this baby we would probably get to belong to for a long time. And in the foster care system, almost immediately when you welcome a child into your home, you meet the biological family. The whole idea is that reunification is the goal. And so you have this family decision-making meeting and you meet the family, but we didn't meet the family. The family wasn't even talked about. It was like they didn't exist until 2 weeks after Coco had been in our care. And we went to court, to the first of many, many, many court dates that are involved in this bureaucratic process. And we met Coco's mother. And at that moment, I realized, oh, this is not what I have been told. So just imagine that you give birth to a child. The child is taken from you. You are sent away from the child. You're not told who the child is with. You never meet those people. You have no idea if the child is safe or where they're living or what their home environment is like or what these people are like who welcomed this child into their home. And she gave birth 2 weeks ago. We meet her at the courthouse. She still, you know, has milk in her breast that she's not allowed to give to this child. She still has the trauma of birth in her body. And she sees these strangers who have her baby. And we meet going through security at a courthouse. And I have Coco in a stroller and I'm wheeling her through security, and we get through, and the mother says to me, can I hold her? And she picks up this tiny baby that belongs to her and just starts whispering to her, I love you, 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 for the whole time that we're at the court. And I think, oh, this is not what I thought it was. You know, this is this child's mother and she wants her back.
You're talking about Evelyn now, about a mother who's had her child effectively ripped from her arms. And I know how much you love this little girl. There's no question about that. You are the personification of what motherhood should be. Just let's go back one step, if that's okay. You had dreamt of being the mother to a baby. This was something that was now in your DNA. It was fused to who you were and to your identity. What was it like to finally bring home that baby that you'd always dreamt of?
It was more beautiful than I could have imagined. I think you don't know, well, can I actually fall in love with a baby that I don't give birth to? Like, is it going to feel different? And it was just immediate. We belonged to her immediately. The love was immediate and deep and could not be undone. And there's no way, I don't see how anyone could parent and care for an infant and not fall madly in love. I mean, I just don't see how that's possible. And we fell madly in love. And I imagined myself as her mother at the same time that there was another mother who was her mother. And so it was from the beginning complicated and beautiful and terrible and one of the most powerful things I've ever experienced.
When was the moment that Eric, the one-time reluctant parent, became a fully fledged walk through fire dad to Coco? Mm-hmm. Because he certainly did.
Yeah, he did. I think there were two moments. So the first, he said in the hospital when he first met her, he had this really primal protective feeling. And Eric is like a radical feminist, like nonviolent pacifist. And he basically was like, I don't know if we can swear on your show, but
go for it.
If you come near her, I will fucking end you. That's what he basically was his feeling. Like, I will do anything to protect this child. And it was like terrifying, just like ferocious, protective feeling. And, you know, that's the thing about the foster care system. We were utterly helpless to protect her. And that feeling of helplessness, I think that parents who've had children who are sick, parents who've had children who die, who have loved ones who die, that feeling of helplessness is one of the most terrible feelings that there is. to feel. So he had this ferocious desire to protect, and then actually this recognition that there was nothing we could do to protect her ultimately. That was the first moment. But the second moment was the first time I ever left Coco. I went out of town with some friends. And of course, the minute that I left, she got croup. I was super, super, super sick. Eric and Coco were together. And he said that that was the moment that he became her father, that it wasn't just a baby. This was his daughter. And she was his, and he was her father. And it was that moment of protecting this completely vulnerable being who was suffering.
That was a magical moment. It was like a changing of the guards. It was just so evident that this man was just the biggest papa bear that ever lived. That came across on the page. But very soon after bringing Coco home, you realize that neither the love you feel nor the safety of your home will be enough to keep her. How do you, as a mother, and I'm going to say her mother, certainly by this stage, for all intents and purposes, do you stay present with this baby you absolutely adore and not collapse in anticipatory grief, knowing that your ability to parent her is likely to be on borrowed time?
Anticipatory grief is a great heightener of presence. I mean, every moment felt precious. You know, I'd been worried that I was going to feel resentment, that somehow she was going to be like in the way of my art, but it was not like that. I felt no resentment. I just felt this complete love of her. But I was terrified of this idea of having to give her back. And I knew, I didn't think I would physically be able to do it, because it's not just that you're giving her back to another family that is beautiful and amazing and safe. You're giving her back to a situation that is not going to be safe, and that you know kind of deep in your bones, no matter how good it's looking at that time, the safety will not hold. And that is against any loving parent's instinct. So I didn't think I would physically be able to do it. And so I did a lot of EMDR. EMDR is a therapy that's used for healing from trauma in the past, but it can also be used for anticipated trauma. So I did that over and over and over and over again, week after week after week, so that I could prepare my body and my heart to do what I didn't feel I would be able to do.
Well, there's a particular moment in the book that encapsulates the anguish for both you and Coco's birth mother, Evelyn. Outside one of the court hearings, Evelyn cries and says in reference to Coco, "She doesn't even know me." And you approach Evelyn and say with so much compassion, "She knows you." Clearly, in that minute, your heart had broken for Evelyn, and you recognise that the work that she's been tasked with by the court in order to get Coco back would have been completely insurmountable for her. You know, this is a woman who's completely under-resourced. She's had seemingly domestic violence partner after domestic violence partner who incarcerated. We're talking about a woman who was living with active addiction. She was indigent. There was so much against her, not against her as a person, but against her circumstances that would have equipped her to parent appropriately. And she'd already lost the custody of another child to foster care. But then you concede, magical Sarah, there was another part of me, a bigger part that lifted. "We're going to get to keep the baby," that part whispered. "She's ours." Ultimately, Evelyn's longing to have her daughter return to her care stands in direct opposition to your hopes and love to raise Coco. What was it like to live this moral dissonance? And what's that like to commit that to writing with such an honesty at all costs approach?
You know, that moment on the sidewalk really encapsulates it, because I love Evelyn. I still love her. I love her and I feel for her. And I know, because she lost her daughter to me, and then I lost my daughter to her. We're bonded by that. I remember one time when I was just devastated in my grief, and I was like, "No one understands what I'm feeling." And Juliana, my therapist, said, "Evelyn does." And I feel that. But Juliana also did some like slapping me around about that, because, you know, I wanted Coco more than I wanted anything in my life. I wanted to keep her, and the wanting of her was desperate and violent and ugly and graspy and enormous. And I knew that for me to keep her, Evelyn had to fail. And so I was rooting against her. I didn't want her to be able to do what she was being asked to do. I wanted her to die. I wanted her to disappear. I have never had those feelings before. I have never been a person who wishes violence on another person. And that was confronting to be like, I have war in me. I have the propensity for violence in me. What does that mean about the stories I've told myself about who I am in the world? And I just wanted bad things to happen to her because I wanted to keep her child. And I had a session with Juliana, and every session I had with her was like, are we going to get to keep her? Are we going to get to keep her? Are we going to get to keep her? And she finally said to me, no, you will not get to keep her. And you need to turn this train around like 180 degrees. You need to stop rooting against Evelyn, and you need to start championing her because that's best for Coco. And for Coco to have a beautiful and safe life, Evelyn needs to have a beautiful and safe life. The two go together. If you're going to love Coco, you have to love Evelyn. And I felt at that moment like, you know, I'd been kicked in the gut. I was like, I can't believe I pay you for this kind of information. Like,
information? That's generous. Yeah. I would have felt that was quite abusive at the time, but okay.
what are you talking about? You know, but she was right. That was my only, I talked about helplessness, that my only agency was that, was to train myself. And it was a practice, a meditative practice, to train myself to love Evelyn as much as I loved Coco. I'd been told that the stranger we were going to love was Coco, but that was easy. The stranger that I was called to love was Evelyn. And that was the hard part.
Well, yes. And it was very powerful, the words that Juliana said. I've got them in front of me, but you've encapsulated it magnificently. I don't need to quote them back to you. But she was very, very strident in telling you that your life doesn't need to be saved. Maybe Evelyn's does. And maybe this child can do that. And, you know, reading it, it was a body blow because I just imagined you sitting there thinking, all I've ever wanted in this life is to love and nurture and protect and raise this child. And you're coming at me with both barrels. But it was evident also that you saw the merit in that because you do forge this incredible love and compassion and care for Coco's biological mother, which was so profoundly moving. And it doesn't mean that it was a straightforward relationship because it certainly wasn't. But she also came to love and respect you and validate you as Coco's foster mother in lots of different ways. I wanted to ask you something. Not everybody's been a foster parent, so they wouldn't necessarily understand the intricacies of going through this process. But it must be understood that the scrutiny and vetting you undergo to become a foster parent is incomparably different to the standards for reunifying children with their biological parents. So much so, and this is what I want people to really understand, that when you ask about the safety of sending Coco back to Evelyn, the social worker says, I wouldn't trust her to take care of my dog for an hour, but then acknowledges that's not the rubric. So, Sarah, what is the rubric?
The rubric is minimal parenting ability, one step above do no harm. I will never forget that moment in the courthouse when it became clear to me that they were going to reunify Coco. And our social worker happened to have a lot of children, some of them biological, some of them adopted, some of them through foster care. And I just said to her, would you trust Evelyn with your child? And she said, I wouldn't trust her with my dog for an hour. And I said, but you're going to give her this baby who cannot talk, who is not in school, could just disappear. And she said, yeah, that's not the standard. That's not what this is about. And I think that's one of the really complicated parts of being a foster parent, which is that you're asked to love this child like they're your own, whatever that means. I really don't like that phrase, like they're your own. You're asked to love this child and then you're asked to give them back. And at no point is that treated like that would be a traumatic act or that would be in somehow in opposition to loving the child. It didn't feel like an act of love to return her. It felt like an act of risk, of extreme risk. And the minute that children are reunified in Idaho's system as it stands, all the supports that the birth family had disappear. So while Coco was with us, Evelyn had access to all this kind of support, mental health, services to help her with her struggle with addiction, access to different kinds of housing, job training, social workers. She had a CASA representative. She had all these people that were there to support her, and she needed the support. You know, the reason that Coco was in foster care is we don't in the United States have systems that are designed to support families, specifically families that are poor and families that are struggling with addiction and families that are struggling with mental health. We don't have any of those supports. So they get those supports briefly while the child is in foster care. But the minute that the child is reunified, all the supports disappear. So you're handing a child back to someone who has just had the floor dropped out from under them again. And the system hopes that it will be fine while expecting that the child will come back into care. So this idea that the child will be harmed again is part of the system itself.
I've been looking at lots of systems lately, whether it's the family court system, whether it's the foster adoption system. It doesn't matter seemingly what the system is, but there seems to be this inbuilt flaw that means that people who need help do not get help when they need it. They get it when the wheels have fallen off.
We're so far downriver by the time a child comes into foster care. And what you're saying is exactly right. People ask me, what do you think we should change about the foster care system? How can we make it better? And I just say, well, end poverty. You care about families, end poverty. I guarantee if you ended poverty, almost no children will be in the foster care system. That's one thing I remember from the training. One of the social workers said, poverty mimics neglect, right? It isn't neglect. It's poverty, and it gets misread as neglect. So I think if we care about families and if we care about children, then we need to increase the social safety net, let people make a livable wage, let there be access to fair housing, let there be access to free mental health care, let there be robust addiction services. Putting those systems in place, very, very few children will come into foster care.
Coco's visitations with Evelyn begin to increase from supervised visits to unsupervised visits and then ultimately to overnight stays. You know when Coco is with you and Eric that she's safe and loved and nurtured. You don't have that same confidence when she's with Evelyn. Knowing that must have literally eaten you alive. You're not just putting a child in another safe, warm, loving home, even if it's not your home, and that's enough anguish anyway, but to know that you are actively putting a child at risk, that would have absolutely sent me mad. What sorts of things, Sarah, did you notice when Coco came home to you after some of these visitations?
She was different. It was hard. It was hard to see. It was around when she was about 10 months old, 9 and 10 months old, that those visits started increasing. And that's a time where, like, they're experimenting with sounds and movements and soaking in the world. And she would come back and she was exhausted. She hadn't had sleep. She hadn't had access to the kinds of foods that we'd been giving her. She was withdrawn. I felt like she didn't trust us anymore. That was the feeling that I had, that she didn't trust us. And it was really painful.
What's the meaning behind the beautiful Hawaiian prayer that you recite over Coco's crib?
Oh, this is a prayer that I'm going to get the name wrong.
I've tried to pronounce it. That's why I call it the Hawaiian prayer.
Because it's a beautiful name.
Is it Ho'oponopono? But I'm not pronouncing it correctly.
Yes, I think that's right. It has repetition to it. One of my best friends in the world, her name's Mylin Dominguez, she told me this prayer, and it was when I was really struggling with Evelyn and those kind of dueling feelings that I was carrying. And it's, thank you, I'm sorry, I love you, please forgive me. And she told me I needed to say that to Coco over and over again. It makes me cry thinking about it. And to say it to Evelyn. I didn't say it actually to Evelyn's face, but I said it when I would meditate to Evelyn. And I remember just lying on the ground in front of Coco's crib and just saying that, thank you. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Because I knew that my negative feelings about Evelyn were actually doing Coco harm. It's a really powerful prayer. The other thing I did that I felt transformative to me was that I did the meditation of loving kindness, which is, may you be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. And you start with yourself, and then you do it for someone you love, then a stranger, maybe to someone you see in the grocery store, and then someone you're struggling with, a difficult person, and then your neighborhood, and then it kind of opens into the whole world. And I used to do that before I would go and meet with Evelyn. And when I would do that, she would look me in the eye. She would laugh at my jokes. I always try to make jokes when I feel nervous. I make jokes. She would look me in the eye. She would hug me. She would laugh at my jokes. If I didn't do that before I saw her, she wouldn't even acknowledge, barely acknowledge that I was in the room. Wow. It was so profoundly different.
Wow. You're in a doctor's office and Evelyn's there too because she comes with you to all of the medical appointments, and Coco is being given an oral vaccination, and if I'm correct, it was grape flavored and that wasn't a flavor mm-hmm. that she was used to, and she threw up on you. What happens next?
This is one of those moments that I wish I could take back. When Coco was with us, we referred to ourselves as, I referred to myself as her mama. And that was a really deep mistake. It was how I felt, but it was not the right thing to do. It was ethically not the right thing to do because Evelyn was her mom. I was her foster mother. And so in the doctor's office, she threw up on me and I referred to myself as mama. I said, "Oh, you threw up on mama," something like that. And I saw Evelyn, like, if she could have killed me in that moment, she would have. She was filled with rage, rightly so. And I said, I mean your foster mom. I like immediately corrected myself. I got so hot. I was like sweating. My face was red. And I got a phone call from the social worker after that. Evelyn had apparently called her like dozens of times telling her what I'd done. And she became convinced that I was trying to steal her baby. And she watched all these videos of me when I had been in Australia doing stuff for my previous book, Draw Your Weapons, where I talked about wanting to adopt a child from the foster care system. And she said, she wants my child. You know, she's after my child. She's all, and that was way before I had ever met Coco, way before Coco existed on the planet. So it was this really intense moment where I was revealed as this person who wanted to keep her child. And so I had to apologize. I had to basically do that prayer. I had to say to her, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. I know that you're her mother." And she said this beautiful thing back to me. She said, "I know you're her mother right now, but I'm going to get her back."
Well, you characterized that as beautiful. Did it feel beautiful? It seems very bittersweet.
It felt like I was going to vomit. But during this period of time, the only person who acknowledged the mother that I had become as a foster parent was Evelyn. She gave me my first ever Mother's Day present. She gave me this beautiful little rose teacup that had a yellow rose plant in it. That's the first Mother's Day gift I've ever been given. And it was from her. And it was parenting her daughter that made me a mother.
It's going to make me cry. But if I recall correctly, she gave that to you on the eve of the Mother's Day weekend, where you actually had to give Coco back to her. The irony of that, the pain of all of that. And you were so gracious about receiving this gift. It meant an awful lot to you, but it was agonizing because you weren't with your daughter on Mother's Day.
No, but she was with her mother.
And that's why you are magnificent.
No, it took me a long time to get there. And that was the truth. And I was helpless. I was helpless to make the truth any other way. You know, I wanted to have a claim on this child. And in the end, I had no claim on her.
Sarah, when it becomes clearer that Coco will return imminently to Evelyn's care, Evelyn asks you whether you would do it again, as in foster again, and you say no, because it was just too painful. But then other people also ask you whether you'd do it again, and you write, "It's not the right question." Why?
I mean, becoming a foster parent's how we found Coco, and so I feel like, of course I would do it again. I want to know her. I want to know her for her whole life. I want to love her for her whole life, whatever that looks like. And sometimes love looks like letting go. I think people wanted to lift that grief from me. They wanted it to turn out different. They wanted to think that I might avoid that kind of pain. But I never would have wanted to avoid Coco.
At the point where there's nothing that you can do to change the outcome, what's left to do?
Right. I mean, you know, I wrote through a lot of this. When we would come home from something horrible, Eric would just look at me and say, "Go write." And I was like, "Fuck you," basically. Like, I don't want to. But I'm so grateful that he had me do that because I didn't have any agency in that situation, there was nothing I could do to make things turn out differently, even though for 90% of the time I thought there was. You know, looking back, I realized there was nothing I could do from the beginning. I had no control, no agency at all. But on the page, I had agency. You know, I could choose to write with generosity. I could choose to write with love. I could choose to write something that would be a love letter to Coco. That's what I wanted. I wanted it, that book, Stranger Care, to be a love letter to Coco. I wanted it to mother her when I was no longer allowed to. And then I just grieved. Grief is such a beast, such a wild beast. And that was all there was left to do.
What did it do to your, it's not to belabor the point, but what did it do to your heart, to your peace, to give your daughter to Evelyn on that final day?
That's the worst day. I think that's probably the worst day of my life when Eric and I had to do that. We had asked the social worker to be present. You know, I come from a theological background. I wanted to be a priest. And I feel like we don't have rituals for the things that we need rituals for. Like, we don't have rituals for menopause. We don't have rituals for the death of a child. We don't have rituals for divorce. We don't have rituals for the things that actually break people's hearts. So Eric and I designed a ritual for that day. We wrote letters to Evelyn. We created this photo book for Coco and wrote her a letter. I brought all this like weird witchy stuff, like rose quartz. Rose quartz had been really important to me in lots of my meditations. And we brought gifts, clothing, and my friends. Once they realized Coco was going to go back to Evelyn, they built her a library. They thought, well, if she can't have Sarah and Eric, she can have stories that might light her way. And so we had this gorgeous children's book library and all these things to give to her. And we wanted Coco to know that she was safe and that she was loved and that she was adored. And so we tried to hide our terror at what was happening. And we asked a social worker to be present, and they wouldn't be. They just left us on our own to hand a child over to this person. And also, there should have been someone there for Evelyn, too. This was a huge moment. She'd worked so hard to get her daughter back, and she was getting her daughter back. So we made our own ritual for that day. But I'll never forget, in our kitchen, we were trying to feed Coco before she left, and she just collapsed. She just was like hunched over in her chair that where we fed her. And I'd never seen her do that. And I thought, oh, she knows. And there was nothing we could do. We had to give her back anyway.
Oy. Nothing depicts the profundity and gravity of your loss as much as when you write, "We took care of her every second of every day for 10 months. When she was asleep, when she was awake, when she was hungry, when she ate, when she played and laughed and smiled. Now we don't know anything." And I read that and I just thought, that's just pure terror. That is just a parent's pure terror. What did you come to hear about Evelyn's decline after Coco left your care?
Well, in the beginning, when Coco left our care, Evelyn and I stayed really close. You know, she would text photos. She invited us to Coco's first birthday party. She asked me to come take care of Coco one night when she had to work late and she didn't have childcare. So we had this intimacy. Like, I loved her. And I think I love her still. And I think Evelyn loved me at that point too, and that she could see what we had done for Coco, that we, by providing her with a safe and loving home, we'd given her the ability to attach to Evelyn. But then, you know, all these supports disappeared. And some terrible things started happening. And then she disappeared. She stopped answering my texts. And so I had no access to her. I knew some of her friends, so I would contact them. They didn't know what was going on. And then I started reading just horrible things that were happening, mostly from social media. I got like obsessed with social media, and I could see that things were no longer safe for her. But her other child who'd been taken into foster care was in a different state. So Evelyn was moving back and forth between these two states. So neither state would take responsibility for her. When I would reach out to people to say, "I don't think that this baby is safe," the people in our state would say they couldn't find her. And the people the other state would say she's in our state, right? So that nobody would take responsibility for it. That was terrifying, because this is a child that is not verbal, that is no longer in school or daycare, that has no eyes on them. And I had no way of knowing whether or not she was safe.
Well, you then find out that Coco's been returned to foster care, but not to you. How does the system conspire to prevent Coco returning to the best home she's ever known, and parents who'd proven that they would literally do anything to be reunited with her, despite the challenges that would necessarily lie ahead because of this volatile raising that she had subsequent to your home? And not to mention the existence of a violent biological father who's recently been released from prison. It just doesn't make sense. Who is advocating for these kids?
Yeah, I mean, nobody is advocating for the children. That was the hardest part of witnessing the foster care system. Here's the system that's supposedly designed to protect children, but really it's about protecting the rights of biological families. At least in Idaho, that's what it is. And that's what we want it to be. We don't want children to be taken from their parents for no reason. But someone also has to look out for the child. And having witnessed adoption now and seeing what's possible in an open adoption, I think there's so many other models for what an expansive sense of family might look like, what supports for a family might look like. Why couldn't Eric and I stay in Coco's life in a way that would be supportive to Evelyn and to Coco, right? But that's not allowed. The case is closed and that's it. We don't get any more information. We don't have any contact information. We're owed nothing. We're seen as meddling or as saboteurs or evil in some kind of way if we're concerned about this child. But she came back into care in a different state, in the state where her brother was. And that family that had her brother, who I now love, but at the time I did not know, Coco was placed with them. And there was nothing we could do to convince the social workers that she should be placed back with us in the only home she'd ever known, the home she'd lived in for the longest. So we tried our hardest. We had several lawyers. We fought and fought and fought, but ultimately we did not win.
Sarah, in Stranger Care, the often asked question of "Do you have kids?" is one you now refuse to ask. Instead, you say, "Tell me about your family." Because you know that belonging comes in all shapes and sizes, visible and invisible, hidden and made, chosen and found. Years have passed now since Coco came into your life, and I would love you to tell me about your family now.
Thank you. I want to share two things. One is that we do know where Coco is, and we are in relationship with her, and we Zoom with her every week, and she's happy and thriving and healthy and loved. And that's all I could ever ask for. I mean, I still have grief. I still wish she was with us, but she's not. But she's in a home where she's loved and thriving and safe. And that's beautiful to witness. And I'm grateful for that. And then the other news is that Eric and I adopted a little boy. We were there when he was born. It's an open adoption. He's a light and delightful, and we're so lucky to belong to him. And we get to know his birth family and his birth sister and his birth grandmother, his birth mother, his birth father. It's been a beautiful, healing, expansive thing to do. And we're so lucky. And he's just over 2 years old now.
That's the best news. Just warms the heart to know that you get to parent because you were born to be a mother. And Eric was born to be a father, whether you knew that at the time or not. And I don't say that in any patronizing or facetious way. You are truly the encapsulation of what parenthood really, truly must look like. And if it hasn't happened yet, I hope, as you do, that one day you'll have the chance to tell this all to the subject of your heart and memoir, Coco, because she'll know that her life was immeasurably enriched because you and Eric were and always will be her family. Thank you so much for joining me on Brave Journeys. It's been such an honor.
Thank you, Tam. You've asked the best questions. I could talk to you all day. Thank you for your careful reading and your big heart and your generous, generous spirit. It's been a real gift to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my love. That was incredible. I don't want this to end, but I know you've got to get back to your gorgeous family.
Thank you.
You are so gifted, Sarah Centillis.
Thank you.
In every conceivable way. Your writing is magnificent, but your heart is more magnificent, if that's even possible. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. You asked me the best questions I've been asked. I mean, you're such a good reader and just really generous with your approach to the material. And so it's a real honor to talk with you.
Thank you, my love.
Oh, thank you. And love to your family.
Thanks, darling. Bye. And this brings us to the end of season 6 of Brave Journeys. 3.5 years ago, I took an enormous risk. I left my well-paid job and threw my entire life and heart into this precious show. From day one, we brought you premium content by design. No ads, just heartfelt conversations from people I now consider my dearest friends and some of the most courageous people I will ever be fortunate enough to meet. But in order to keep bringing you the incredible stories of hope and inspiration you all love, we need you. That's the only way we can stay independent and create content that you won't be able to find anywhere else. Without your support, Brave Journeys won't be able to continue, and that's simply unthinkable. So please, at an absolute minimum, share Brave Journeys with everyone you know. Brave Journeys was created, hosted, and executive produced by me, Tam Faraday. But I couldn't do this without my wonderful team, including my incredible audio editor, Melissa May, and a very special thank you to George Weinberg and Ursula Ferguson. But know this, without you, there would never have been a Brave Journeys. So let's keep the conversation going. Your emails and messages across socials mean the world to us. You can ask me any questions or chat about any episodes on Instagram at Tam Faraday or at Brave Journeys Podcast. I'm Tam Faraday, and please visit me at my new website, tammyfaraday.com. That's Tammy with an I. And finally, before I go, this season we've been so excited to announce that by popular demand, Brave Journeys is now mobile. So you can experience the magic of Brave Journeys up close and personal with Brave Journeys live on stage. To arrange for me to come and bring the transformative power of human connection, reciprocal candor, vulnerability, and the thrill of shared experiences to your next boardroom lunch, conference, or live event with either a guest of your choosing or someone from within my arsenal of remarkable guests, please visit Tammy Faraday and click Book Tammy. Please stay safe, look after yourselves and each other. Always, but always lead with kindness. Until we meet again, please catch up on all 60 episodes you may have missed along the way and join me by following the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts. Wishing you all a happy holidays, a blessed 2024, and I'll see you all soon.